Ladies and gentlemen,
this is Gamertag Radio.
All right, everyone, so we're going to continue with Gamertag Radio's 20th anniversary. And man, I've never had this person on our show right now, Adam Boys. But Adam, and we know each other for a long time.
Long time, Adam.
We see each other at events and everything. And thank you for coming on the show, man.
Thanks for having me. I wanted to wait 20 years, Danny. I want to wait 20 years for the invite.
And then wait another 20 years.
I've been waiting in your garage, just waiting to pounce in.
It's all good. So I know you've been in the industry for a very long time. You just launched a new company. Tell us a little bit about that.
Did. Man. Yeah, Vibrato. Yeah, I've been in video games for 29 years. It's been an amazing journey. Started in quality assurance as a game tester at EA back in 96. And then worked my way through production, through business development, worked at companies like EA, and then I went on to work at Midway and Capcom, and then at PlayStation. I worked there for many years, launched on the PS4, and I was the guy that did a little video that went viral.
Oh, we're going to talk about that.
Okay, all right, cool, cool, man. And then Iron Galaxy for the last 8 years with Dave Lang and Chelsea Blasco. Chelsea and I were co-CEOs, and that's a big game development studio that does a lot of co-development. And through that journey, I love that team so much. It was fantastic to build that team up and expand it in Nashville. Making games is hard. And what I realized through my journey there is I started talking to people about the biggest challenges that the industry is facing. You know, we've gone through a lot of changes in the last 4 to 5 years in the gaming industry. So I started asking people a very simple question, which was, what is the number one biggest challenge in the games industry? And Danny, the first 10 people I asked gave me 10 totally different answers. And I was like, that's kind of weird. Then I asked 20 more people, and luckily I started keeping a list on my phone. I asked 20 more people, I got 18 new answers plus the other 10 I had. And the more and more people I asked, the more different answers I got. So I kind of was like sitting there thinking to myself, why is everyone giving different answers to the same question, which is, what is the biggest problem? And it was very sort of very particular about what their answer was, that they thought that was it. So then I was like, well, okay, obviously our industry is in a hard spot if all these different sort of issues are getting raised. So what are we doing as an industry to sort of get through it? And that's why I started hearing that people were leaning on, you know, consultants from New York and Boston and all these outsiders coming in to give our companies advice. And I was like, okay, well, that doesn't make much sense because they don't understand. It's like, you know, you as a dad know exactly that when other parents give you advice on being a parent that aren't parents themselves, they're like, hold my beer. And I feel like a lot with consulting or giving feedback, if you haven't shipped a game, if you haven't published a product, if you haven't launched a platform, it's very difficult as an outsider to give any advice. So that was the impetus of like, okay, if we can build a more Imagineering-centric sort of methodology to consulting to give advice to big companies, publishers, developers, platforms, private equity, venture capital, to help them understand the industry more with a bunch of people that understand how to operate and ship products and make games, then hopefully we can bring more health and wellness to the games industry. Because I think that's what we're missing right now. We have all this advice of people trying to extract capital from the games industry. But in reality, we also need to think about the people, the spiritual sort of underlying of the games industry and the health and wellness and longevity and stability to ensure that we're going on a good path as an industry and we're going to be around for the next 50 years. Because, man, I've been a gamer since I've been a wee lad, and I don't want this industry to break or to face these challenges.
And let me ask you this, Adam, because and it relates to this. You know, there's been a lot of changes now the past couple of years. You know, Xbox is changing their strategy, you know, and other companies are trying to do new things, you know, making more games on mobile, or now they're releasing stuff like PlayStation now releasing games on PC also. The industry has been changing compared to like the early days when you started in this industry. Like, what do you think is the challenge right now of, companies are still trying to figure out what might be like the next big thing, or is it more of like let's figure this thing out altogether, man? Because it's been very complicated like the past couple of years with like the layoffs and everything like that too.
I think the best way, Daddy, to explain it is let's think about like the Atari days and Coleco. Let's go on the Wayback Machine. And when you're making games, like sort of games probably fell in like 10 different categories, and then as consoles got more complicated and we got to SNES and beyond that to maybe like PS1, there almost became like 100 different styles of games you could build. You could build a racing game, an RPG. There's a lot of different options. And that was true through like PS1, PS2, PS3, Xbox 360. I think we hit this interesting point around the PS4 era and the Xbox One era where there almost became infinite choices, right? What business model do you have? Are you free to play? Are you subscription? Are you MTX? Are you this? Are you that? And so went from having 10 choices back in the 80s to 100 choices in the 90s and early 2000s to now we had infinite choice. We basically hit the multiverse and now there's infinite threads we can follow. And I think what I see a lot of times is people see a thread that's successful and they try to go back and replicate it, right? They take different ingredients to try to replicate it. Oh, if that game was successful with these ingredients, let's just try to do the same things. And you can't really predict for how tastes are changing because now there's more sort of people playing games than ever before, but they're also in totally different places, right? They're different age groups. They're just different interests. They might be coming from Roblox or Minecraft. They might be coming from Candy Crush. They might be coming from Call of Duty or Destiny or Marvel Rivals, right? You never know where they're coming from. So the predictability of the industry, I think, is really different. How we make content is totally different now. The fact that we can plug into any international development team and work together, that's different. Costs have risen. So that's actually what I realized with all these answers that I got. The whole foundation under our feet has changed. So it's very difficult for anyone to look into a crystal ball and say, if we just do these five things, we're going to make a lot of money and make gamers happy. You almost have to try things. And that's why I give so much space to modern day companies that have to do a lot of pivots and trials and errors. You know, watching your guys' interview with Phil was really inspiring. And him talking about how they've evolved and changed their tactic. Back when I was at PlayStation, it was very different. We were very standoffish with each other. You know, it was the console wars. I was a, you know, lieutenant in the wars. So I know very well what that looks like. But I think the reality is now, it's just about getting great content to as many people as possible and trying to create like a very vibrant garden of opportunity and success for developers, right?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad that you brought that up about Phil and you know, their strategy. I love it. I like the path where they're going, but I feel like the messaging is a little bit confusing for like the average consumer. Like, so sure. I think one of the questions that Paris asked Phil, yeah. Hey, look, and it's hard. We only have like a limited time. I wish we had a longer interview, right? But
sure,
one of the questions that Paris asked to Phil is like, okay, why should I buy an Xbox? Why, you know, your thoughts about that, where a company like Microsoft now going multi-platform, you know, those days, early days when you were at PlayStation, you know, it was, we have the exclusive, you only can find it on this console, you know? So
yeah.
What are your thoughts about that change and that strategy that Microsoft is heading?
Yeah, I understand why people have feelings about it and opinions, because if their idea is the identity of me choosing a brand and being beholden to that brand is like, you know, unilateral, and therefore that should be the one source of all content. And I love that Phil mentioned, like, there's a box in the name, right? Xbox is part of the name. But I do think if we think about it sort of the analogy of, like, they were Blockbuster that became Netflix. And what I mean by that is when they began, it was about the physical unit being the sort of entertainment experience in the living room. And that was basically a plastic player that you put discs in and it plays it. So you need to serve people with the physicality of it. Retail and partnerships are important, right? You and I both waited in many lines at many early morning openings to rush in there and sprint against everyone else. I usually lost the race, by the way. But, you know, to get that console as fast as we possibly could. And it's just different now. So now they are basically an entertainment provider and not just a disc sort of producer and distributor. So if we think about that, the analogy of, like, if we think maybe PlayStation's the HBO, Microsoft's the Netflix, and Nintendo's sort of the Disney, if we think about things like that, then their job is to get an incredibly interactive and engaging entertainment out to as many people as possible. And that's why I'm totally down. Now, you're absolutely right that when you try to sell someone the new version, is it 8K, is it 16K, is it 32K, where are we going from here? Right now, I'm happy with the number of Ks, you know, in the fidelity. It's great. Then the value proposition changes. And I understand why traditionalists are looking at that being like, I don't like change. I want it to only be where I want it to be. And I just, that's the part where my logic gap starts to break. Because when Phil and his team are putting amazing content on more platforms, mm-hmm. Who's the victim? I've been asking a lot of people, like, who's the victim? And there aren't any, except for people that are just like, well, I want it only where I bought it, and that's what I expect. So I think that's interesting. So I applaud them for being agile enough in a sort of changing and transition market to expand. But I agree with you that like the value proposition of that physical unit, that by the way, they weren't making a lot of money on anyway. No one makes a ton of money on the margin of those hard boxes. They make a lot of margin on selling content. So them leaning on that, I don't think it means it's the end of a physical entertainment unit in anyone's living room. But I do think that it's a sign of that the game sort of landscape's changing.
Yeah, I think I could see people saying, you know, if I buy an Xbox, this is the only place I could find Xbox Game Pass. It's not available on, let's say, on PlayStation or Nintendo Switch 2 or something like that. I think that makes sense. So maybe having something like a new feature that's not available somewhere else.
Sure.
I think that will work. Well, people will buy the product. Now, one thing I do want to mention, because I know you brought it up earlier, you know, and this is one of the conversations that stayed in my head for a very, very long time. We had this conversation, I think it was at DICE. I can't remember which. I think it was like 2 years ago or so, Adam.
Yeah.
Where you brought up and you mentioned to me you told me the story about how the whole game sharing moment, remember the video you did with Shu, how that, in a way, now thinking about it, you feel bad because it's like promoting the console war nonsense, you know. And look, back in those days, especially like in the 90s, that was something that, you know, companies like Sega, Nintendo were Sega than Nintendo, where they were promoting that just to get people excited and buy the product. And I know every other company did that, like in the early days.
Yeah.
Why do you felt that moment? Like, hey, you know, that wasn't good. That wasn't healthy to promote that for like the industry.
No, nowadays. I think, Danny, I think it's like, would I have done it again? Absolutely. In that moment, my role, especially as someone who was both a huge Xbox fan and a PlayStation fan, but I played a PlayStation fan on TV, which is, by the way, before I go to my answer, one of my favorite moments was when I first met Phil Spencer. It was at a Minecraft party, and I'd just gotten the job. And, you know, I was being a little bit lippy on the internet, like I was doing in my role. I think maybe I'd done my first E3.
Yeah. And he
comes up to me, shakes my hand. He said, Adam, lovely to meet you. And he said, I love the character you play on the internet. And that was some game-recognized game stuff. I'm like, because he is such a real dude when it comes to, like, playing stuff and content. I love that about him. And that was the moment where I'm like, okay, we're going to have fun. Yes, we're on other sides of this war. But what I meant by that, more so when I look back at now and current days of negativity, right, it sort of creates this, now when I look back at like the current sort of console war discussions online, I do feel a tad bit responsible that I contributed to that at the time, right? It was a moment in time. Now, they changed all the policies. Everything we complained about, they changed all of it, right? Everything I tweeted about, all the stuff, all the complaints I had, all the trolling I did, Microsoft changed all of it. Like, they evolved with the masses, and that's why I give them a ton of respect, is because if you're willing to stick stoically with your position that other people are against and never change. But I just look back at that and especially finding out later on after I left PlayStation how many people over there were very angry at me for a long amount of time. And it's like, I've always just been a gamer first. And so I think in that moment, you know, could you have done stuff differently? In today's world, I think there's just so much negativity. Like, let's instead, you know, fight for progress and hope and evolution in the brightness of the future versus, which is kind of what those were. So again, would I have done it again? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But I look back differently as you get older, as you age, and as you think about, like, what is the best use of our time here? And I definitely was, you know, playing the role that I needed to play at the time.
Yeah, but I mean, now that you have a new company, I think that's going to help to make the industry even better. You know, your contributions, ours, and other people, it's going to help to make the industry, I think, better, you know?
Hopefully. And again, being able to do that pattern recognition of, like, what do I see the issues that I've seen before or the decisions? Because that was the thing that was, when I saw their announcement on how they're going to handle content, that idea for that sharing video came instantly to me. I'm like, oh, it's like five steps, and you got to do this, and you got to read through. You remember reading the FAQ? Remember they put out the FAQ? It was like three web pages, and you're like, going through, you're like, so if you have a parent account, and I was like, this is insanity. And I was like, what if we just did this thing where I just said, here's how you share games? And everyone in the leadership team of PlayStation was like, that's awesome. And then that just comes to be, But it's like now I can do that behind closed doors and be like, you guys understand how convoluted, wacky this whole process is. Yeah. I don't have to make another video again, you know? Should I?
But let me ask you this. Was Shu down to do that, like, right away as soon as you gave him that? Or it took some time?
So I sketched up the idea. I actually wrote it on my phone. I was flying to LA. We were always, what was the name of the stadium we would always have the E3 press conference, the Sony one?
I can't remember.
The old LA, anyway. So I was on the flight, and that's when the idea hit me.
The Forum. Was it the Forum? No.
Was it the Forum? No.
I don't remember.
So I was on the flight and I sort of like wrote the idea of like, oh, I just went through it. And it was actually the Giant Bomb guys at the time were reading through. They did a whole 40-minute video trying to like break down what the rules were on Xbox. And like, you got to do this. And they're like so confused. And I was just like, I'm like, oh, we should do like, here are the three steps. Or here's one web page. Or here's, and then that was like, what if we just did one thing? So typed it up, emailed out to our head of marketing, Jack Trenton at the time, Andy House. Landed, went, dropped my stuff off, went straight for rehearsals, and I ran into Shu. I said, I have this idea. I said, I think we could like really grab the moment with this confusion around the policies. And I told him the idea, and Shu goes, I love it. I'll do the commercial, or I'll do the video. I said, awesome. I said, we got to find who else will do it. Maybe Jack will do it with you. And he's like, no, your idea, you do it with me. I'm like, I'm new. No one knows me. Had I even done E3 yet? I don't even know.
I think that was maybe your first.
Was that my first?
Because that was the year. That was the year you guys announced the price of the PlayStation 4.
Yeah, I guess that would have been my first time on stage. Mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah, because I remember leaving the venue, and you guys were like high five and talking and celebrating. I remember that.
After we allegedly changed the price 2 minutes before, like I love. What I love,
Danny,
about
rumors, just
the ridiculousness. It's hearing people tell stories, they're like, and then they just change the PowerPoint of the price of the game. I'm like, never. The idea of a multi-billion-dollar decision being made in response to someone else's PowerPoint is unfathomably ridiculous. But it's a fun story to tell. Like, and then I heard they just went to the PowerPoint, edited the slide, like never happened.
No.
So Shu loved it. And he's like, you got to be in it. I'm like, I'm not an actor. I'm not, this face is from radio. Okay. For Gamer Tag Radio. And so then we went to, Andy House at the time. And, we pitched him the idea, and Andy's like, oh my God, I love it. He goes, we should film it here and put it in the press conference. Like, put it actually in the press conference. And then we went to Jack Trenton. And he said, I love the idea. Get it out of my fucking press conference. He's like, that is not a press conference message. That is like a behind-the-scenes message. And I love that because it was. Most people, by the way, and I've had people, multiple people, tell me to my face that they were in the stadium when they saw that video on the big screen. I'm like, it's never played on the big screen. Yeah.
I was there.
Was not on the big screen.
But
we tweeted out, dude, it's a Mandela effect. People swear they saw it. We never played on the big screen.
We did. No, you did. Nope. I said it down.
We never did. Danny,
really?
I swear to you. Now, Jack was doing a speech, price, and then he did the sharing. He talked about the sharing policy, but our video never played at E3.
I'm trying to remember if I saw that.
Dude, you're not, there's so many people out there that think that's how it worked.
Okay.
Behind the scenes, so Shu and I are backstage, and we basically, Shu types up his tweet, I type up my tweet, and as we hear the roaring of the crowd from the policy share, I hit send on both phones, and that was when the video went out. So it was behind the scenes as sort of a moment. So a lot of people fuse those things together, like Jack's announcement with two chuckleheads doing the sharing video.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was just sort of shocked at how people understood my logic of like, and by the way, I give so much more credit to the creative services team at PlayStation by doing that whole long step one.
Yeah, that little graphic.
That is.
Yeah. That was beautiful. That was great.
Then we filmed like seven takes of like, I remember that was easy and saying a bunch of different stuff. But how it came to be.
Now, and I was going to ask you also about, things that's happening now at PlayStation, because it was very different when you guys were there, man. I feel like you guys were very open to meet the fans, you know, doing a lot of things to interact with them. You guys had like a lot of events. I remember during like E3.
Yeah, PlayStation Experience was super fun.
Yeah, stuff like that too.
Yeah.
We don't get to see that anymore with PlayStation, man. I don't know if it's something where budget or what. Like, I honestly do miss that part of PlayStation. Well, what are your thoughts about that? Like the changes where they're more kind of like Nintendo in a way. I mean, Nintendo still have like their stuff here and there once in a while, but it's not like the PlayStation Experience, like stuff like that. So
yeah, man, I just look back fondly on the time that we spent, because I feel like any big company gets to change and evolve and adapt over time, and every new leader that's running an organization gets to make their own decision about what's right for their business and what's right for the company. Mm-hmm. I think we were very lucky because Jack embraced it, and then Andy House specifically, right, who was a global CEO at PlayStation, loved all the big ideas that we had around that stuff. Now, when you look at the revenue or the profitability of having a consumer event, it's not a very good idea from a business perspective. You and I had a great time. The fans had a great time. But when you actually think about like what's the impact, yes, there's a feeling and vibe perspective. But you know, I respect anyone that's running a business being like, okay, what are the important things that we need to do? And maybe we need to invest in other parts of the business, right? So it definitely feels different, but so do press conferences. Back in the day, we could sneak on Yu Suzuki and have a Shenmue 3 Kickstarter announced. Nowadays, it's more of like, hey, let's do it. And each of them are different, from the Game Awards to the different, you know. I love the, by the way, the Dev Direct that Xbox just did, like telling the stories of the developers, having them be able to explain the context. And that's what we try to do a lot. Remember when we had the 9 indies on stage?
Yes.
And then each of the people got to say a little bit about their game. I love when developers get to tell their story. And that's what I love about, you know, what you guys do is really try to put the emphasis and the focus on the studio. So, yeah, man. I mean, everyone changes and evolves over time. Did I have fun at those shows? Absolutely.
Oh, we all did. No, the reason is I missed the getting together face to face interaction with not only with the people that worked on the product but also the fans, and it feels different. Like even like you said earlier, even when you go to a store, you know, during at midnight.
Sure.
Like, I miss those days. Now everybody's like, well, I just do it from home, you know?
Yeah, just order it. I'm in the queue.
Yeah, exactly.
Hopefully my browser doesn't refresh.
I hope the download speed goes a little bit faster, you know? So, but another thing I was going to ask you is also live services games. I know during your time at Iron Galaxy that you guys also had a live service game. Like,
yeah.
It's like a hit or miss with every other game that's been out. You know, like how difficult is you know, working on that? And also, what are the changes that you would like to see in the future to help studios to make a better live service game? Or forget about the idea, do something totally different that's not that.
Yeah, man, that's a great question. It starts with, you know, live service games are difficult to build. I think they were built out of the premise that, you know, players are going to spend a lot of time within an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, I kind of liken live services to sort of esports, right? If you're building a cool game that you think might have like online longevity, then having a long-term content strategy is probably important, right? Just like maybe if it's competitive, having an eventual esports strategy is important. But I think getting back to, is the core game super fun? Do people love it? Do they enjoy it? You know, with Rumbleverse, very proud of the team, the work that the team did putting that game out there. We had a lot of fun making it. But the other thing is, like, it's harder now than ever before to predict what players are going to do, how they're going to play things, how long they're going to play things, what kind of things they're going to purchase. And because products come and go, and because there's so many choices for them to play, right? If you talk to anyone right now, you're like, hey, you have 8 hours to play anything you want. They're like, oh, so many choices. I'm going to probably play something I played 2 days ago or a week ago versus trying something brand new. So I think part of the biggest challenge is, back in our day, there was 8 websites you went to and they were telling you every day what kind of games are coming out. There was very sort of a small amount of places that we could interact with that we got our information news from. Now it's infinite, right? You can get it from any source. So I think part of it is trying to, you know, predict what players want is very difficult. But also I think overproducing or the busting budgets, I think is a big challenge too. Like, do we really need to have 4 years of content planned when the game is going live day one? I definitely think having a more agile approach, having sort of smaller games that go out there and show more innovation is a good approach. But dude, I think people's tastes are going to change and evolve all the time. And how we navigate and try new things, I think, is going to also change.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, again, to see what happened with the studio that worked on, what was it, Concord?
Yeah.
For PlayStation. Yeah. I got to see the potential. I see why people didn't like the game, but it was just like how PlayStation shut that game down, like the live service game, right away. I think it was like, what, a week after launch?
Yeah, it was not
I've
long.
Never... In my life, I've never seen something like that before in this industry. You know, do you think that was a good idea to shut it down that fast? Because I can see a year, 2 years from now, I can see a game maybe didn't work out, but a week, it's scary. It's scary for a developer that's going to work on a game like that.
Yeah,
Is it going to stay up or not? You know.
Yeah, I mean, same with us with Rumbleverse. I mean, you know. Game comes out, people are playing it, people are enjoying it, and then, you know, there are numbers that have to be hit internally. They can do trajectory projections based on sales and downloads and people that are paying money for it to sort of model out whether it's going to make money. Mm-hmm. It's never the right time, dude. Danny, it's never the right time to cancel something or shut it down, right? It's always the wrong time. So whether it was beforehand, whether it was the day of, it was 2 days after, a week after, a month after, 6 months after, it's always going to be hard. What everyone needs to realize, and this is what was really difficult internally in Iron Galaxy when Rumbleverse got taken offline, is it's not our fault, right? We tried something cool. We put something new out in the marketplace, and the Concord team is very proud of the work that they did. Like, they all worked their butts off to build something that they believed in. And because the players didn't believe in it and market didn't believe in it, that's okay, right? Imagine going to a friend's house and your friend's parents whip up some awesome dinner that he loves or she loves, and then you're like, nah, it's not my thing. You're like, well, it's their thing. So sometimes we miss the mark as an industry. Sometimes we make bets that don't pay off. And I don't think we should all grab our torches and try to find who is the person, one of the people, how did it happen? I mean, these things are going to happen. It's sad to see that much investment and passion get flushed down the toilet. But in reality, if we stop pursuing big dreams and different things, and we only go after small things, I don't think that's the right approach. I also don't know if swinging big bets for $500 million is a bit big bet either. Yeah. I also don't believe you should read everything you read on the internet or believe everything you read on the internet about the price of things, because there's a lot of sort of noise that goes around with how much things do and don't cost. But also for me as an insider, you know, everyone's allowed to have their own opinion. They can have their own take on it. They can be angry. They can be frustrated. They can be disappointed. They can, you know, especially with the background of us versus them with Xbox, PlayStation, everyone can have their opinions. I don't personally think that us spending another year talking about the Concord situation of like trying to unpack it, we weren't in the room. Like, a lot of people asked me when it first happened, what do you think happened? I was like, a series of unfortunate events. It's as simple as that. And so none of us could say it was that person and that person, or there was some people that were in there. No, everyone had the best intentions. And so when those things happen, we should reflect for a bit. But then again, we should, I think, move on and try to learn as much as we can and invest in the future of innovation in games.
Yeah, totally agree. Totally agree. Now, and we're almost going to wrap it up here, but this is one thing that I love about, and I heard about this, you know, through, I think I read this online and other people were mentioning it too. Were you the one that actually gave the green light? Was it you that gave the green lights for, I think it was a Spider-Man to come on PlayStation? Was it you? Were you worked on that? Or was it somebody else?
I was not the green light man. I was in the room with Marvel. So it was a little bit different.
Yeah.
Marvel was very, we were passionate. John Drake and I.
John, there you go. John was Drake. Yes,
he was heavily involved. John Drake, super awesome guy. We were both involved in having a conversation with Marvel. They were interested in doing some stuff. I can't remember exactly the timing of everything when Ted's and his team realized that was the IP. But I do know that when they came back around and we presented it, was definitely we were in the room. But I have to give all the credit for the concept, right?
Yeah.
And Ted's team for being like, we want to do a Spider-Man game. But we were in the room when we gave the Marvel team the news, John Drake and I. And John Drake did a ton of work working through that project and that partnership. So if anyone's going to get credit, it should be him mostly. But it was such a fun transformative moment.
I mentioned the job before.
Yeah, it's such a fun transformative moment. But, you know, it takes a village, right? So many people get involved in that stuff. The team at Marvel is amazing, Jay and everyone. And it was just, in that moment, it was this like aha moment of like, it's amazing studio with Insomniac. It's a fantastic IP. We're just lucky to have been there to help be part of that story.
Yeah.
But oh man, what a incredible, incredible outcome. Dude, that last one was, I just loved. Spider-Man 2 was just so many highlights for me.
Hey, Miles Morales for me was like my game because that was a time where I was like away from my family and that game is also from New York too. So I was like missing home and everything. Oh, it was so good.
Yeah, but Ted retiring is this wonderful sort of cherry on top. He's such an incredibly positive force in the industry and he's really been an inspiration. He'll be sorely missed, but at the same time, he deserves all the time.
Well, I'm going to talk to him. I know he's going to be at DICE, so I can't wait to. We never met before, so I would love to say hi to him.
He's just the kindest guy ever.
Yeah. No, I was gonna mention that because of the Spider-Man thing. Was there any projects that you worked throughout your whole history? They're like, man, I'm proud of that. I'm proud. I was one of those people that worked on that project. Besides the sharing, the sharing video.
Yeah, that was obviously. You know, at Iron Galaxy, I definitely think one of my favorite moments was getting the Diablo 3 port for Switch, meeting with the Blizzard team. I'm a huge Blizzard stan from way back in the day. Like, I'm a Warcraft 1 and Warcraft 2 on Cali, where I was playing online back before, you know, my BBS would connect online. So I've been my lifetime. I almost got a two-headed ogre tattoo when I was 18 from the Warcraft 2 instruction manual. So that was a big moment for me. You know, Rumbleverse having something that comes from Chelsea saying, we should do wrestling. And then us being like, I want to elbow drop somebody off a 40-story building and then that coming to market. Like, that to me is, it's moments like that that you're so proud of, that a team over a 3.5-year period can build something so special, so unique, so different that never would have existed if all those people weren't working together on something inspiring, right? So those are some ones. I mean, back in the PlayStation days, I almost think, to your point, man, the PlayStation experience, just, you were there. That feeling, capturing that feeling, if we could bottle that and sell that, that would sell better than, any of these GLP-1s, I think. It would.
Yeah.
I mean, because the feeling of being around people that like mine, it's kind of the feeling I get when I go to PAX. Of like, that was just so magical. It's connecting with fans and being able to make dreams come true and bring games back that people really wanted. You know, of course, he's building a list campaign and being able to bring back Yakuza and, you know, Grim Fandango and stuff like that, and Shenmue. Those were so many highlights and an incredible team. I mean, what an awesome team that I got to work with.
Yeah. No, another question I was going to ask, your thoughts about Nintendo Switch 2, like the change. Do you feel like Nintendo is going to have a huge success with this one, or, you know, similar to what happened with the Wii U? I think that was like a very complicated situation from going from Wii to Wii U.
Sure.
Where it got a little bit confusing for like the regular consumers. I just want to hear your thoughts about the
console. Well, dude, I love, first of all, that we get a handheld launching with whatever, tens of thousands of games out the gate. The fact that the backward compatibility, that's such a game changer.
Yes.
That's super, super exciting. So that in and of itself. And I do think, I mean, you guys were touching on this in some of your previous chats, but handheld gaming for me, when I'm on the train, when I'm on a plane, is so incredibly important. And, you know, I'll echo Phil's words that with my contacts and my readers, you know, I play Balatro on my little phone, but playing Balatro on the Switch 2, let's fucking go.
Yeah. With a bigger screen and all the way.
As more information comes out, you know, I'm excited to hear more details about it, but I'm jazzed about it, man. Nintendo is just, they always crush it. They haven't even talked about their games yet, and you know they're going to be so good. So
yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited too, man.
Yeah, I'm hyped for it for sure.
Yeah, man. Well, Adam, I just want to say, man, thank you so much for being on, and you know, good luck with your new company. Do you have a team, or just you for now?
Yeah, I got a small team right now working with me. We're going to grow over time, but you know, we got to. It's going to take takes a village. So
yeah, of course, you know. Yeah.
So it's slow rolling, but excited to get to DICE, do a cool workshop to try to solve some of these big problems in the industry, and you know, the future is super bright.
No, I'm glad that you're still going at it, man. And the thing that I love is you want to change the industry, man. You know, we had a lot of conversation about that behind the scenes. So I'm glad that you're making it happen, man. So
thanks, man. I appreciate it, Danny.
Cool, man. So for more information about your company, anything else, how they can find you?
Yeah, vibrato.com right here. Vibrato. You can send us a note, contact@vibrato.com. You can, there's a contact form as well you can fill out. We'll be putting out some more content and more news in the future. And if you're a studio company that wants to get some help and some advice, some insight, reach out.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks, man.
All right. Thanks, Danny.
Yep.